Welcome to Empathetic Machines. I'm Christine Gonzalez-Wertz.
And I'm Jeff Fisher. Welcome to Retail Done Right on Empathetic Machines. Today, let's talk about the role of people in the retail experience. Let me set this up. We're in the era of the customer channel. Shoppers now call the shots, and retailers and brands need to embrace, support, and optimize their entire operations to support their customers and how, when, and where they want to shop. Have there been changes in the role of physical stores? No doubt. There's been trending happening for quite some time now that happened even pre-pandemic, as well as the pandemic has expedited a lot of these. We have mission-driven shopping. We have limited visits. We have less traffic. Returns. An educated consumer who's researched extensively online, as well as new shifts like fulfillment in store and curbside pickup. We're still shopping in stores, and as a percent of in-store versus online, the vast majority happens in-store, 84% as of the end of last year. Okay, but let me share. I was just speaking with a dear friend of mine about how during this pandemic, our personal shopping habits have changed. We were comparing notes. For us, we're now shopping for groceries once a week. We order our groceries online, and then my husband and I drive to the store together to have them put our groceries in our trunk. We don't need to drive together, but we do. My friend and his partner shop for groceries together. Also, they drive to the store together once a week, but in the UK, you cannot shop together. So only one person goes into the store because only one is allowed. Vicky goes into the store, does the shopping, and Paul stays in the car while she's shopping. Our habits have definitely changed, but we're still going to the store together in an odd sort of way. Today, let's talk about a fundamental element of retail, people, humans, and in relationship to physical retail in particular, the frontline staff. I've invited two former colleagues of mine at Sunglass Hut and who are now currently helping retailers win with the consulting firm Next Performance Horizon, which I can't wait to hear more about. Welcome, Jackie Culp and Lou Chessman. Both are very experienced in store operations, which is an understatement, having been zone vice presidents with each responsible for well over 250 stores. I don't know how many people that is.
3,000 or so.
Oh my God, that's great. Jackie, how about sharing a favorite shopping experience with us?
Absolutely, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. And I don't think it'll be a surprise to anyone that one of my favorite shopping experiences happened to be buying shoes. I was working and had to take a conference call. So as I walked around the mall, I found myself in the Nordstrom shoe department, of course, intently listening to the call, but also browsing.
Found yourself.
I know.
What an odd thing.
I found myself. I just drifted there.
I find myself there as well.
So a salesman approached me and, you know, I motioned, I apologized, motioned to my phone, probably somewhat dismissive, but he found a way to reengage me. He watched as he saw certain shoes that I lingered at, and he came up, picked up the shoes, quietly asked my size, and said, I will have these put aside waiting for you whenever it's convenient for you to come back and try them on. Later in the day, I went back, of course, bought a couple of pairs of shoes. You know, so the fact that he acknowledged me, let me shop how I needed to shop, truly cared about helping me, because I've certainly experienced the opposite, where they look at you on the phone and just treat you, you know, in a way, was really what made me buy, because I certainly did not need to buy a new pair of shoes. But I have found in the world today, we don't need, but people, that interaction with the human interaction is what makes you want to buy.
We are social. We are social creatures. I love that. And talking about embracing the new, right? He's been able to figure out how to make that work. Lou, welcome.
Hey, thanks for the invite, Christy and Jeff. Man, I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to talk about my most recent shopping experience that is still memorable. My wife and I talk about it today because shopping to me, it's an adventure. You know, majority of the time, I'm on the hunt for something new, different, unexpected. As such, I define my favorite shopping experience by the term itself. It's got to be an experience. And my most recent memorable experience happened when my family and I, we were just on holiday in Florida, where we finally stumbled upon a surf shop done right. The store layout was emotional as it immersed you in this gypsy surf lifestyle. It had this VW wagon in the middle of the store that they utilized as a 360 immersion display They had a really cool safari pop-up tent in the back of the store as a women's destination. Now, keep in mind, we have three young children. They're between the ages of 5 and 8 years old. And anyone that has kids, you know, let alone three kids at that age, you know, shopping is a challenge. But this sales team, they enhance the experience, making it so emotional by engaging my kids. Look, the end result of this experience was we walked out not needing or wanting anything, but ended up purchasing $500 worth of clothing, accessories, and treats. After leaving the shop and sitting in the car, the kids asked if we could go back in, as they each wanted to see one more, touch one more, play with one more, and of course, buy one more thing. And of course we did.
They won.
Yeah. When you got three of them, one always wins, I tell you that.
Well, you know, I was thinking, if you're doing that the next time, can I be invited as one of your kids?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And that's the piece. I would say that when you've captured the hearts and minds of children in a retail shop, man, I would say you've done retail right.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think engaging the kids is fundamental. Harkens back to my time at Lego when we were doing the first Lego brand stores. And because really Lego at that point had some theme parks, which are pretty phenomenally immersive, but also were really starting to explore doing their own physical stores because they were dependent on third party to put their products on their shelves. So one of the things that we did is once we built the first store, we walked through the store on our knees to make sure that we wanted to overwhelm the kids with this sense of worlds, you know, models that were built there, as well as how we merchandised it. And the whole point from an operations team's perspective was to engage the kids first and the parents second. So it sounds to me like the surf shop was doing exactly that. Okay, let me start this off now by going into some topics. Technology and the transformation in consumer shopping habits gets most of the press right now. So I would just love for you both to share your insights into one of your guiding management principles, the idea that people work for people, which I think is beautiful and very insightful. Jackie.
Absolutely. To give you a background, I've been fortunate enough to have worked for more than 18 years for a leader who truly believed, truly modeled people work for people. And that allowed my leadership to evolve continuously over the years. I believe in servant leadership, you know, the practice of putting the needs of the employee first, empowering them, giving them the opportunity to be their very best and perform at their best. I think it's also important to meet people where they need to be met, both personally and professionally. I'd say one of the most important pieces is you need to be present and you need to pay attention. When you ask someone, how are you? You need to take a moment. You need to listen. You need to pay attention to the response so you can connect with it. And oftentimes
you need to mean it.
You need to mean it. Oftentimes people ask the question and they don't hear a thing the person says. But that is the start of building that trust in the relationship. People know you care to hear what they have to say.
Spot on, Jackie. When I think of that term, it's not, or the phrase itself, people work for people. This is a phrase that reflects the value of the relationship. So to Jackie's point, man, like if you're asking somebody how they're doing, you better mean it if you value the relationship. The way I look at it, Jeff, is if you're a leader, you're in the relationship business. Relationships are fostered when people feel listened to and valued. But Jackie, the listening attribute you were talking about, man, it takes a lot of practice. It doesn't come easy. As you referenced, you have to be present in the moment. You got to listen with an attitude of genuine curiosity and interest in the other person. So when you're asking, how are you? You actually have to be curious. You know, I'm really interested. I want to know how you're doing. Finally, you mentioned empathy. When you listen with empathy, it's actually saying, I hope. It's a hope I have that I can get a sense of the other person's perspective, feelings, actions, and desires.
You have to care, right? You have to really care. I think empathy is actually spot on. I mean, we're all humans. We have a lot going on. We have a lot of responsibility at our day job, especially that frontline staff, But there's a lot of other stuff going on too. We're individuals, we're deep. So I think the fact that you both also modeled that really went a long way in terms of performance and from my vantage point in working with you.
Yeah, I have been retail, and like every member on this call, I've been on both sides of that retail transaction. And if I had a few extra hours, I'd still find my way into Williams Sonoma owned entity, just because like I do worship at the altar of their discount. But you know, physical retail is, as Jackie noted, people plus people. It's also people plus stuff. And great retail managers work not just to create a customer experience, but that staff experience. And you know when you walk into a well-run retail store, especially at closing time, because people are cleaning, but they're not too busy for customers, and there's a sense of purpose around the action. But I digress. So here's my real question. Can it go too far? We've been talking about this, and there have been conversations lately about people who kind of have felt they had to drink the Kool-Aid or really go away from their authentic selves to be present at work. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. There was a Business Insider article specifically about a toxic environment at an athletic or an athleisure retailer. And I felt like when I looked at the article, they were asking questions. And to your point, Jackie in particular, and to, you know, your point, Lou, it is very kind of scary that they might ask for somebody's opinion or to quote unquote clear themselves of a challenge they had in the day and then not respond or be able to tell somebody that was not something that could be cleared and not relevant to bring up in a group dialogue. How do you handle or how do you address those kinds of challenges?
Wow. Christine, it's not easy because you're talking about culture. When you talk about drink the Kool-Aid, it's about are you embracing, digesting the culture? For the most part, even that term, drink the Kool-Aid, reflects that you may not have hired the right person, or you may not have been clear about the culture and the expectations of the business upon bringing that person into your business. So you're trying to continue to immerse them to foster a particular type of culture. I'm familiar with the article that you're talking about. And I do want to keep in context a little bit about this article. The Insider spoke with more than a dozen current and former employees, and they have a lot of stores. Plus, not all the employees the Insider spoke with attributed negative experiences to culture. Some blamed individual managers, while others said their experiences were generally positive. With that said, the meat of the article seemed to hone on exactly, Christine, what you were talking about, clearing. Clearing itself is when an employee starts a shift with an exercise in which the shift manager actually asks that person in a group setting whether they had any issues they wanted to bring on the floor that day. In theory, this is a good idea. I mean, look, the retail shop floor, it's a stage. It's where the associate interaction complements the curated collections, the enhanced marketing. And the point is to leave at the door anything personal before you step out on the stage for your performance. Now, there's a lot I'd love to seek to understand from this retailer. The first thing that came to mind, though, when I read the article was the labor spend associated with clearing that ensures it can be executed appropriately. Jackie mentioned earlier, just how are you? The intent of that alone, if you value relationships, takes time, right? Good isn't good enough as a response, let alone me asking you, is there anything that you don't want to personally take on the floor today? So I would like to seek to understand the labor spend associated with that enables that to have a real conversation. Plus, what does the training look like that they provided to the leaders having that conversation that enabled them to act on the expectation of clearing? Look, however, the article that Insider provided, it portrays it as just, it seems to lack authenticity. It doesn't seem that clearing is about building relationships to reinforce the brand's culture, but rather just one another task, which the manager isn't actively listening, you know, just checking boxes.
It's a bit of a slippery slope, right? Especially, specifically when you're talking about clearing, because what I'm hearing from you is that you can even address this in terms of asking, how are you, and caring about the response and the interaction at that point, right?
Yeah. You'll know if there's something to clear at that point in time if you listen to the response.
And Jeff, when you think about a meaningful conversation, when you just ask that question to a family member, a friend, how are you? And you get the typical shtick, I'm good. You usually, no, man, I really want to know what's going on. Like, how are you? You have to emphasize it because most people think you don't care.
And you really do have kids.
I do. I should practice clearing when they come home from school.
Lou, do you have the time? Do you have the time?
And that's what it comes down to. Any relationship really is, the relationship comes down, the conversation is the relationship. And conversations take time. That's why they say a relationship is an investment in time.
Well, you are talking culture and you're talking relationship. I think you absolutely hit that on the head.
With that article, I'd say, again, keeping it in context, another concern that I saw expressed was the continuous feedback about one's demeanor or lack of smiling on the sales floor. So that was a pain point, if you will, for the associate. Now, again, most brands have a selling or service model that guides the customer experience, but at its forefront, it needs to be authentic. You have to allow each associate to be natural, to be themselves, in order for them to do the best they can to meet the particular needs of the customer. So each of us has a unique personality. Each of us, you know, may have a different way of connecting with a customer that's reflective of that personality. At the end of the day, it's all about what is the right way to interact with the individual customer. And you can't cookie cut that. You can't say, you know, for that particular person, as I could hear the pain of what they were expressing, customers seem to like me, but I must be doing a bad job. You know, I don't have any problems with the customers because their facial expression, whatever it may be, on the sales floor didn't seem to meet what they wanted to see. You know, you can really beat that dead horse and keep bringing it up, and it you know, took a toll on the person mentally, personally.
Well, I resonated with that because I don't necessarily walk around every day with a smile on my face. I think Lou hit it really well. The sales floor is a stage. You know, retail is theater. I think there's absolute truth in that. And you have to go into that type of a job knowing and understanding that. It's not for everybody, but everyone also doesn't have to have the same super smiley face. People can interact with people in very empathetic ways that are real, possibly having a certain expression on their face. So, you know, that one resonated with me. And I think you're right, Jackie, that people come in all shapes and sizes. And actually, I think that's what makes us better.
We're all unique.
That's one of the reasons I feel warmly about Trader Joe's and their people. One, I believe they've tried the products. Two, I believe they will tell you what they really believe about those products. And three, I think that they're allowed to be individuals, and that really makes a difference. Before we go anywhere else, we need to kind of take a quick sponsor break. Hi, and welcome back. And we are here with Jackie and Lou and Jeff. In the first part of Retail Done Right this week, we talked about people and how they come to work. While they're there, they also sell and they restock and they merchandise inventory, but they also handle returns. Some days it's good and some days not so much. But Jeff, you seem to think returns are an opportunity in the new world. So I'm all ears because I hate returning things. And if you can make it better, I want to know.
I hate returns too, but maybe I should say that I actually hate to return things myself. But I think I'm in the minority there because according to the National Retail Federation, in 2020, there were $428 billion in returns. Online returns more than doubled from 2019 to 2020. Doubled. And in 2020, e-commerce accounted for $565 billion, or 14% of total U.S. sales, and approximately $102 billion of merchandise purchased online was returned. The survey found that for every $1 billion in sales, the average retailer incurs $106 million in merchandise returns. And also, let me just reiterate, online returns more than doubled from 2019 to 2020. If I'm not mistaken, retailers and brands should be driving their customers to making more purchases in store or at least inviting customers to bring their returns to the store. This could save shipping costs, opportunities to convert the sale to an exchange or to an additional sale. It reinforces the role of the store. If customers bring their returns to the stores, the operations team have a better chance of converting into an exchange, and even probably more importantly, to help build that relationship.
This goes beyond just returns and can look at how you optimize things like disposal and recycling. Different jurisdictions have different regulations. And I'm not sure businesses should count on their employees being able to remember all of those regulations and pieces. And especially the broader the assortment is a retailer carries, the harder that is. A returned mascara is technically a biohazard, and returned electronics, no matter how often you tell people to contact the manufacturer, often have minerals in them, in the batteries, in the devices, that mean that it should not go in the trash. And while that used to be difficult, then we had COVID come along. And my concern is that when organizations are writing off goods in the return cycle for fear of restocking them, there are handling protocols. And the upside gain of that of restocking was not worth the downside risk, whether that's imagined or real. So I think that we need to look at these from both the operation side, but also the people side. That's what we need to make sure we're getting right in this environment.
Lou, I think the physical stores do a better job with interaction with the customer that results in lower returns, which only benefits the retailer and I think benefits society overall with regards to waste. Really curious from your perspective, being on the front lines of this.
Jeff, my perspective is returns are a killer. Period. And another reason why brick matters. You mentioned that if you're returned into a store with an associate, the opportunity for that associate to diagnose the reason you purchased it in the first place, you bought it in the first place. So why are you returning it? Sometimes it's just a manufacturing issue, right? Sometimes it's a fit issue. Sometimes it's just I can't afford it right now issue because the credit card bill came in. Anyway, you slice it. The cost of a return to a store, right, versus a distribution center, it's 75% less. So retailers should be doing everything in their power to drive that return back to the store.
Totally agree.
The return's it's a give back, Jeff, on the sale. It's a give back on the margin. At the end of the day, retailers are just absorbing the cost if they don't do anything about
it. It's an opportunity for the relationship, too.
Well, exactly. And then you stated earlier that retailers incur an average of 10% returns. However, one large footwear retailer had online returns amount to 3 pairs of shoes per every pair the customer kept.
How is that sustainable?
Well, it's a pretty big footwear retailer.
Still, oh my goodness. You're absorbing a lot of costs, or you're absorbing them in one place and you're charging them back in another place.
Yeah, the operations nightmare there.
And the waste, right? The operations nightmare, the complexity, the cost, the waste.
The other piece I was going to mention, Christine, you're spot on regarding the complexity of returns by the varying rates of the category. It also complicates the overall costs.
Absolutely. I mean, we all know, and Jeff, you're absolutely right, that human interaction and being able to ask some questions and uncover why the customer is returning it can potentially find them what they need. But, you know, I'd say so much has changed in the last 12 months and will continue to change going forward. We need to be flexible as we figure out what this means to each particular business. In the coming months, as things continue to open up, people are going to want experiences and in-person interactions. I think that will be a combination of buy online, pick up in store. I do that at Target now, and I've never gone in to pick up my item and not continued to shop. So, I mean, that's a genius for them. And also traditional in-store shopping. But returns are always a part of the equation. The one thing I will build, Jeff, to your comment on companies encouraging the customer to come into the store. Kohl's has taken this to a whole new level by accepting Amazon returns in their 1,100 stores nationwide. And this came after a 100-store test in 2019. As I, you know, saw that article they wrote, it was truly a traffic driving priority when they put this into action. And it's done exactly that. It's driven customers into the store. And so it's rolled to all of them.
Yeah, it's a fascinating idea. I've seen it. I've seen it in action. I've watched it in a Kohl's. I think it's a fascinating idea to drive traffic into your stores with the customer having a completely different idea, but they're not putting the Amazon return in the front of the store. It's the milk in the back. You know, it's you got to walk through Kohl's to get to that. There's a lot of temptation on the way in, and there's a lot of temptation on the way out.
And they give you a coupon just in case you want to buy something on the way out.
Exactly. And look, it's worked so well for Amazon, their relationship with Kohl's and the returns. They just now opened up Amazon returns to their Whole Foods stores.
Wow. Yeah. So there's something there.
Yeah, it really brings to heart the milk in the back now, right?
I think that we've talked about the bottom line impact for returns, but this is a way to build traffic. And as physical retail struggles to be profitable, lean, and efficient, labor has always been sort of this way to save money for retailers. How does that change the particular store level P&L? Does it need to be blown up? Is we look at what COVID has done in terms of downward pressure on retail sales per square foot, which according to Colliers were in 2020, they were about 340 down from about 380. And even that number needs to be segmented because it's such a melange with Apple at the high side at 5,500 a square foot and Tiffany at 3,000 a square foot, where you've got Walmart and Target down on the other end, both being extremely successful at $400 a square foot and $300 a square foot. Yet no one advocates kind of putting them all together. So is dollars per square foot still a metric we should be looking at in the time of all of these business changes?
Wow. Look, the overall labor line, if we're talking about the actual in-store experience with the associate, isn't really measured by dollars per square foot, but it was really managed as a percent of net sales. When the sales increased, and as a dollar, when net sales declined. And I only preference that because you talk about the traditional P&L kind of being blown up. You could make a case for that, Christine, because we're no longer in traditional channel of store retail. Some have even said, and I believe I may have heard it in the past 30 minutes, that we've even evolved past the omni-channel retail.
We have.
To the customer channel.
To the so-called customer channel retail. I love that term, Jeff. Love it. And you're so in the right space. Look, retailers, you know, they need to take into context the operating margin per channel when forecasting a P&L. You have to factor in costs, including running the distribution center, the shipping, the store costs, the channel-specific overheads. If I was to break it down for you, any of these channels, Christine, that you referenced, let's just take a $100 shirt. If that product's shipped from the DC to the consumer, it's approximately 36% operating profit. That same shirt purchased in store has slightly less profit, but still north about 33% OP. Now, if it's purchased through the BOPS, the curbside, as Jackie does with Target all the time, that OP goes down to about 23%. Now, retailers are okay with it for Jackie because Jackie not only, you know, buys online, picks up in store, but buys more in store. And that's really the intent there. But let's not forget ship from store, which only nets approximately 17% operating margin. And then we were talking earlier, Jeff, returns. Man, you throw returns into that equation, which we mentioned takes 10% off that OP, plus that the average shirt cost 3% on that margin line to process in store versus 8% via ship back to DC. Look, I'm going to chunk this all down, the numbers really quickly, because if you order a shirt, ship from store, and return to DC, the retailer is at an operating margin loss of 1%. They lose money on that sale every time. I don't know if I answered your question, Chris. but what I can tell you is if you're managing your retail business through a traditional P&L, man, you're in bad shape.
Yeah, and I think that the point is that you should be using your stores to develop more Jackies than to develop more of the other kinds of customers. And the challenge is how you make that store experience so fabulous. And let me just circle back around to where we started, and that's people helping people. Wow, what a thought. So even the return process, as much as this is about where we started, and that's got to be around the way people help people.
Right. You know, I'd say as Lou, Christine, everyone stated, there's no longer a traditional business approach. No one could have anticipated the world was going down a year ago, but it did. And so we made adjustments and we adjusted. But everything we've talked about so far, from buy online, pick up in store, curbside delivery, buy online, return to store, in-store shopping, it looks different. And every one of those channels takes more labor hours, from executing COVID protocols to physical delivery of the product to the consumer. So at the end of the day, they all impact P&Ls, and it's an evolving process that really needs to be looked at very differently with each channel.
I completely agree. I think retailers have to look at their P&L differently, and if they're not, they're in trouble. And I think it's really interesting as it relates to an entire direct-to-consumer strategy. The role of the store continues to change, as we've perfectly explained here. There's also a bit of a halo effect at times with brand presence from a marketing perspective of having physical retail stores in markets too. There's a really interesting relationship in a very different way of looking at P&Ls from an ecosystem perspective across all the touch points, across all the points of distribution, across all the quote unquote channels that are now happening. There has to be a complete rethink of that.
How do you educate people to do that? I'm sorry, I'm just going to dive right in, because I think that is so important, that the fact is, we had a sort of punt all of our education modules in the last, you know, in the last year to create new ones. So what do we do?
I think there's a lot of absolute data, the pure sales data, right? But there's pure sales data from a channel perspective. But there's also the ability to analyze what happens when you build a store, and in what is happening from a performance, traffic online, searches, shopping online, your social media presence, your social media likes. There's a geographic region that you can start to evaluate now as well, that looks upon performance, not just of physical retail stores, and performance of or sales performance on your online, but you have the data available now to be able to look at what's happening across all of these points, from sales as well as from all of your other touch points with the consumer. You also have, hopefully you have a loyalty program, and you have the ability to develop really rich data on value driven by that. I think that you see retailers, I mean, as an example, you see retailers like Nike going significantly going towards a much more of a direct-to-consumer strategy, and they're putting stores in locations, and then they're looking at the assortment of exactly what they're going to sell based on what's happening across their ecosystem, their online sales, their social media performance and sales, and so in selecting store locations from that and customizing assortment to that as well. So they're clearly already looking at this from a different perspective than a traditional P&L at a store level perspective.
I think also the building the business acumen and the education, it's using the data, as Jeff talked about, there's so much out there. But I think if you understanding the why, we started talking about the frontline associate and how they can connect with that customer you know, coming through the door and how all that impacts the P&L. I think if you ask someone who hasn't really researched it, how much business was done online last year, I think you're going to hear the opposite, right? You're going to hear 60%, 70% of all purchases were made online, because that's people's belief if they really do not understand or look at the data. So I think there's that piece of just education, you know, at the front line to the associate. Why do you want the customer walking through the door? They have to understand the why so that they can be open to it.
I think it makes sense to talk about Wawa. It's a very interesting little store. You know, I mean, it's a regional convenience store, fuel and convenience. And it is crazy in the sense that they are nearly double the amount of spend per visitor than other stores. And part of it is the way they do themed promotions and events and engage their staff. But the other side of it is everybody in a Wawa tends to be nicer to each other, and people hold the door for each other. And I think that that goes back to something that Lou said at the beginning, and that's about culture. And I realize you can kind of teach culture, you can hire well for culture, but are there any lessons you guys would, you know, bring to the fore for how to help make that happen more solidly?
Wawa, I mean, love Wawa. But again, I'm a Jersey boy. And anyone that hasn't visited a Wawa, or if you visit the Northeast, I also think it trickles somewhere within the South as well, but it's predominant in the Northeast. You got to go seek one out to experience it yourself. The interesting thing about Wawa, I think it's somewhat similar to Chick-fil-A, right? You have a high ownership of running those franchises. I don't know much about the Wawa model. I'm very familiar with the Chick-fil-A model, but when you have an owner that's not overextended, that only owns a location or so, and they have to be in that location, you're going to have a better overall culture. You just are, because the point of an owner, and you can label it an owner of one store or the guy that owns 1,500 stores, and you can title that them any way you want, their responsibility is to foster culture. That's really what it is, foster culture. Now, you can try to, you know, after you define it, to your point, hire it, and then you try fostering it. But I think you're diving even deeper. We were talking about metrics earlier. But the purpose of a metric is to identify first, what's the behavior, right? What's the overall consumer behavior, the associate behavior? And then what you want to do is you want to start measuring that behavior. Now, once you identify the right behavior, which is challenging enough, and then if you can, you know, strike a bullseye that you're actually measuring the right metric to that behavior, now this is when you talk compensation, Christine, right? If what you want to do is motivate people, right, to behave appropriately, you got to then compensate the behavior. All three pieces, though, very rarely do you see anyone that gets all three right.
I think physical retail does a couple things or supports the customer better than any other way of shopping. One of them is browsing, inspiration, touching, tactile, just the idea of shopping, going into RH and Crate and Barrel and getting inspiration for my home, buying something for my home, adding to that. Local bookstore, changing hands here in Phoenix. It's almost impossible to walk out with only one book. They do such a great job of curating. They do such a great job of interacting and being able to suggest and help steer you in terms of the right book. I think good retail is curated retail, and I think good retail is experiential. And from an experience perspective, one of my favorite projects has been at Sunglass Hut. And you, Lou, you mentioned this earlier. It's when we reconcepted the Soho flagship for Sunglass Hut, we created what we called a pop-in shop at the back third of the store. It was designed to rotate every 3 to 6 months based on what the concept was. And we opened with a collaboration with Mr. Brainwash, who not only recreated his studio in the pop-in shop, which was, I think, really phenomenal, but he, in addition, and I think this was the beauty of Sunglass Hut and Luxottica, is that he was able to create a limited edition series of sunglasses for Ray-Ban. We had the ability to merchandise and present that as part of this pop-in shop, totally immersive experience. Second was a fully immersive experience, video projection, sound design, lighting design, in partnership with Burberry, where you walked into the pop-in shop and it felt like you were, it felt and sounded and smelled even like you were in the middle of a rainstorm in London. And through the video projection, the sun started to come out and it became so bright that you put the sunglasses on that you carried in there. You weren't walking in there with your sunglasses on because it was too dark. As a takeaway, you got a short video that you could share on Instagram. I mean, obviously, goes way beyond the physical store, social media, connectivity, interaction, PR, marketing, but it also brings relevance and shows the relevance of physical retail. It gives people a reason to visit. It can introduce you to a new audience. But I also think that to make this happen, the front line needs to take ownership, buy into this and support it. And it's obviously one of the biggest components of making this happen. This was in your region, Lou, when we did this. So I'd love for you to kind of talk about it from your side, whereas my side was much more on the design and the strategic planning side.
Well, you know, the overall concept of a pop-in shop is extremely memorable. I think still today, it's, I would consider it revolutionary. You know, you look at retailers all over, are focused on collaborations. You need to collaborate to win in retail today. But they're collaborating on products. What this strategy was to collaborate on the in-store experience. It was remarkable. And when you provide a luxury global powerhouse or a renowned street artist, and you give them an opportunity to take over part of your store, one thing happens that comes to mind: energy. Energy and the impact of energy is at the epicenter of the customer experience, the associate experience. It's why people take pictures and post. You know, what they're doing is they're reflecting the energy within their life. The associates are excited to work. They're excited about where they work. They share that excitement with their customers and friends. In a way, in a world of influencers that we live in today, you're creating brand influencers and brand ambassadors with each and every associate. And I'll tell you what, I mean, that beats your macro, your micro, your nano influencers every day of the week when a brand can make that happen.
Energy is at the epicenter of the customer experience. I mean, those are beautiful words. I love that. Am I in a bubble, or are we even talking enough about staff, the front line, the people that make this happen at the store level? We should be talking more, I think.
I really hope that we can count on Jackie and Lou to kind of continuously come back and give us their experience.
We'd love to have you back.
We'd love to come back.
It would be a pleasure.
Let me wrap this up. It's about the customer channel. Tech is helping to make retail better, but more importantly, tech is helping to support the way customers want to shop, how they want to shop, when they want to shop. And physical retail is a central part of the direct-to-consumer strategy. And in physical retail, the staff is a key differentiator. I'm going to put both you and Lou and Jackie, both of you on the spot right now. And I would love it if you could each tell us one thing that retailers need to do tomorrow based on this conversation.
Love their people.
Love their people.
Love their people.
Perfect.
I totally agree.
Yep. Perfect, Lou. I love that statement. You know, as I said earlier, that listening and making sure that the person knows, especially in the times that we're in right now, your associates need to feel that they are valued. And that's loving your, you know, just at the end of the day, they're the ones who make the connection with the customer. And we said earlier, people work for people and people buy from people. So your customers need to be happy. You need to love on them. You need to appreciate them. And I think it's really important to understand all the whys. If you want them to execute for you and understand why you want them to do any of the different pieces, they need to be part of it. I mean, that's part of the value of an associate, is that they are respected enough to know the why is it that we want to do it this way. So it's not so much, Christine, about the Kool-Aid as it is about them being owners.
And having the last word, this is the beauty of owning the podcast. There was a company I worked for, and over every door, there were the words, consider yourself a customer. And it was, I would joke around and tell people that I was fully bought in. I had drank the Kool-Aid, and I believe in that. And I don't mean it when I say it in a bad way. I just think that sometimes when you are so fully bought in, you just, that's how you show up to work. And that is a beautiful and amazing thing.
Lou and Jackie, tremendous conversation. Christine, thank you for the collaboration. And I hope that this continues and you come back and talk with us. And my last note would be that maybe I got the last word.
And listeners, thank you so much for listening. We couldn't do this without you. Look us up on empatheticmachines.org. Leave us a message or a comment. And you can find us on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon. If you want to find us somewhere else, drop me a note. I'll post us there. Bye-bye.